Hello, and welcome to Kinder Conversations live at 180 House. I'm Catherine.
And I'm Robin. We're the co-founders of Kinda, the women-led neuroaesthetic studio. We work as a bridge between academia and the creative industries, translating insight into creative projects to help art, culture, and technology work harder for people's well-being.
In this series, recorded at 180 House, we have been hosting informal conversations about the rise of neuroaesthetics, the exciting space at the intersection of neuroscience and the arts.
Across six episodes, we're exploring connection and immersion in our daily worlds through interdisciplinary conversations. Each session considers a provocation, asking us to consider new design paradigms through the lens of neuroscience. How can we better use scientific insight to fuel creativity and build experiences with greater meaning and impact?
To answer these questions and more, we're joined by a range of incredible guests from the worlds of art, sound, neuroscience, and of course, yourself.
In this episode, Catherine will be discussing nature connection, its huge importance, how we might have lost it, and crucially, how regrowing it can help us become better stewards of the planet. Catherine is joined by Dr. Rosalind Watts, clinical psychologist, founder of Acer Integration, nature lover, and one of the most prominent voices in the field of psychedelic research. Alongside her is Dame Judy Ling Wong, an environmental activist, former UK director of BEN, and a major voice on policy and practice towards social inclusion. So, let's head straight in. This one is special.
Welcome, everybody. Who here has heard of Nature Connection? So for me, it is many things, but I'm going to start with Roz, actually. To you, what is Nature Connection? Because interestingly to me, until you created the connectedness scale, which is incredibly hard to do in science, so that's amazing in itself, there was no clinical scale for connectedness, is that right?
Yes, so I trained as a clinical psychologist, and connectedness was not something that we ever studied. It was not in any of our textbooks. Connectedness to nature was certainly never considered as something that was part of our mental health. My introduction to what nature connectedness is has come from my research in psychedelics. So starting off with clinical psychology mainstream, taking a left turn into psychedelic therapy, and realized through the patients with depression that I work with that they were having these spontaneous experiences after having psilocybin experience in a clinical trial. They were spontaneously becoming more nature connected. So it wasn't part of the preparation, it wasn't part of the therapy model, but they were just naturally starting to say things like, I used to think that nature was a thing, like a TV or a painting, and now I realize that I am nature. So they would have these experiences of, I think, in order to answer your question more succinctly than I possibly could, they taught me that for them, and now for me too, nature connection is feeling part of an interconnected web of life, and that they didn't feel that before. So particularly because they were suffering from depression, but I think most of us suffer from this, regardless of how depressed or anxious or troubled we may be, a deep disconnection from the web of life, because in our culture, in our society, those interconnections have been obscured in different ways. And it was like people plugged back in and saw the web and understood that they were part of it. And then it's not, I mean, I don't want to idealize it like, oh, they felt part of it. And then it was just, they were part of the natural web of life and it all was easy. When you know you're part of the web of life, it can be very difficult because you can become aware of the challenges that we face at the moment. So it's not always a simple, simply good thing.
But what is amazing is that it is sort of measurable and malleable, right, as a scale. We can change it. So I'll ask you, sort of, you, Judy, the same question. To you and your huge amount of experience in years in nature and with people in nature, what really is nature connectedness?
It would be obvious to you that I come from the East, and that I represent and valuing of multicultural contribution. And as part of that, They are what I call the cultural visions of nature, which extend our knowledge and awareness of what we think about nature and its connection. To be connected to nature and therefore able to feel fully alive in itself is actually ultimately purposeful and meaningful. And it is because we are nature and not part of it, we are at one with it, that we feel lack. The lack that we talk about arises out of a contemporary life that is very Western, dominated by the intellect, in which we define who we are and what the environment is, often framing it as separate. Our disconnection is why we do not care enough and why we damage nature, because we do not identify with it as ourselves. That sense of lack that we feel is a sense of being incomplete. It is about damage. We're always connected, but in the main, we're connected with what is damaged, our damaged selves and our damaged environment. So the feeling of lack is, for me, an indicator of disconnection. We humans are, in fact, completely and always connected. Our feeling of lack comes as we connect, some of it physical and aspects of it conceptual and contextual. We are born of nature and we are nature, so there's actually no escape from connection. It is very simple. We live in bodies. Everything that we eat is alive. So how can we be disconnected? Everything around us is extracted and ripped out of Mother Earth. So enabling positive connection is about how we may be enabled to be totally and sensually present, recognizing clearly that our relationships to ourselves, to others, and to all of nature are present all the time. Beyond the physical, the power of our intellect nowadays alienates us and constructs nature's absence through ideas or even practical actions. For example, technology in modern life can lead to simple, repeated actions that diminish our aliveness and our sense of connection, feeding the sense of lack. Look at something as simple as turning on the lights here. Yeah? It cancels out the sensual experience of the stimulating rhythms of light and dark throughout the day. Even on a grey day like this, we're privileged with these subtle changes that we can feel, that we actually feel better, although there's artificial light on. So, at the end of each day, for example, as the sun sets and the drama of moving into darkness that we once as people used to feel, are cancelled out. Too many of us, without a second thought, just turn off the lights and the entire experience disappears. Every day, that drama of fading from light into darkness, which is so much part of nature. So we need analysis of our senses and cutting-edge science to track what is happening to our connections. Science must constantly extend its territory into the full spectrum of the experience of humans as nature, especially through the arts. Delving seriously into the physical environment, the realms of emotion, diverse cultural ways of being, imagination, and spiritual dimensions. So analysis and science can help us to be more consciously rebuilding our connections, heal and claim the huge joy of the aliveness of being fully at one with nature.
Thank you. I think it was something that Judy said to Roz and I earlier that really struck when we were sitting over there complaining that there was no nature around, and she made us pick up our teaspoons. I think everyone has got a teaspoon in front of them. They just pick it up. You explained to us, didn't you? It comes, where does that metal come from? She actually pointed out that we were sitting on sheep's backs because our feet are on a woolen rug. and that the wood all around us was come from the trees. I think for me, that has been the most sort of revelatory point that you've made this morning, that actually we are couched in nature right now. Everything that you're eating there is becoming part of you. And that's the first mind shift that I think has to happen. You know, stop this divide between sort of nature and city. You know, we're in nature all the time. And I think I really loved the fact that you said, you know, the environment is not just green, is it? It's more than green. What did you mean exactly by that?
For example, what Catherine has just repeated from what I said is that we are always in a landscape. And we ourselves as being alive, I mean, I'm vegan. You can look at me and say, I'm actually a pile of vegetables. Yeah. And the nature conservation movement has been so successful that it's run away with the word environment. When we say environment, you immediately think green and nothing else. It is not true. What about the air? The air pollution campaign has made us aware that, well, air is part of nature. Walking in the sunlight is contact with nature. Mm. So we need to begin to reclaim everything that's around us, in us and ourselves, to say, hey, actually, we're in touch all the time. But the point about this, we're constantly in touch with damage.
Yeah, and that's a really important point. And I think something that probably speaks to your work as well, Roz, because you sort of, you know, have done a lot of psychedelic trials, but beyond that, looked at connected nature and how and the healing properties. So we have these two dynamics. We have the damage that we're causing and the healing that nature can cause to us. And in return, that we can create, we can heal the environment. What were the benefits that you were seeing, was of this sort of relatedness to nature when people came out of these psychedelic experiences?
Well, I think it was quite momentary, because there was nothing to support that nature connectedness. So because I think it's quite difficult to access a way of feeling deep wild nature. So it's fascinating to hear your perspective about, you know, we're always part, you know, everything around us is nature. But I think there's something about walking through a wild landscape where you can smell the smell of the trees and you can feel the earth and you just feel that sense of, that feeling of walking into a forest, deep nature. It's sometimes hard to get that feeling from a park, because I think one of the things that psychedelics do is they kind of deactivate our ego, our default way of seeing the world. And we're often quite defended. We're in our heads. We're thinking about all the things we have to do, kind of ruminating about the stress of our lives. And it's quite hard to let go from that and really immerse in the rhythms of nature like that, you know, the cycles of light and dark, the smells, the heartbeat of nature. So I think people desperately wanted that and craved it, but it was hard to access it. If they didn't have an amazing forest on their doorstep, then one woman from the psychedelic clinical trials was saying, you know, from her balcony in a block of flats in London, that she could see a park and that she could see that it was much greener and that felt amazing. And she would go and walk in that park every day for a few months. But it was like, I could see that we needed some way of that opening that was happening, some way of enhancing that, making it easier for people to access deep nature with other people as well, like nature and community at the same time.
And I think that's really important, something that you can speak to as well, the idea of community. I think you said, was it in the 80s when you started, Judy, it was people for nature, not nature for people. You know, what are the benefits that you've seen in this change that is gathering?
It's a very healthy development that we have this two-way street paradigm of people for nature and nature people for people. But the ultimate thing is that we need a shift in the framework in which we see things, which Ross was talking about, where there is a culture that allows you to increasingly make connections. Ross talks about the use of psychedelics where people momentarily feel this intense vision and connection to what different cultures call the spirit of nature, and so on. But within those cultures, they have continuity. When they have these experiences, they have centuries-old wisdom of guidance. You're not left on your own to these experiences. You're guided. And there's a kind of debriefing when you actually finish to make sense of what you actually experience. And of course, these so-called psychedelic experiences, that label we give them, are actually part of the range of experiences of life within those cultures. I mean, the whole culture of Peru and so on, they take ayahuasca all the time, you know, as a part of life, because it's a range of experience and it's situated and continuous with a way of life and a way of thinking. That is why they are powerfully enveloped in being part of nature. So these kinds of things we struggle for in the West because everything is separated and not inculcated into this. So I use phrases like people with nature and nature for people at the level at which ordinary people can understand. But some of these deep experiences are outside people's experience in the West, whereas very normal in experiences in the East. And you don't just have to take psychedelics. You have all kinds of facilitating mechanisms from the East, like deep meditation, where you make connections and so on, which opens your mind in such a way that you can receive the power of nature. It is really interesting that people talk about when they are given these experiences in forests and so on, they feel the power of nature. And it is true that we have the cohesive presence, like trees, which are powerful beings and so on, present, that you have this multiplied power around you, which if you're open to it, you will then experience. But the importance in the West is to be able to carry that experience into ordinary life. They not just forget it, you carry it. And therefore, you accentuate the presence of yourself as nature in continuity. You accentuate the presence of everything, the spirit of the table, the spirit of the carpet, that becomes present and alive to you. Then something different really happens.
And I think, you know, it's wonderful to hear you both speak about it in sort of from your own perspectives and from mine, which I always want science to be expansive and not reductive. And that's part of the reason why I think it's important for creatives and scientists to have these discussions, you know. And for me, you know, as a sort of latecomer to nature connection, latecomer to nature, even though as I realize I've always been part of nature, it was so fascinating and sort of validating to see all these studies start to come out. You know, the sense of vastness and accommodation and awe and wonder that real experiences in nature can have, and the long-term impact on they increase your pro-social behavior, how kind you are to others. They increase your connection to yourself. They can be healing on a sort of physiological level. But beyond that, you know, they can, as you mentioned, the default mode network, one of mine and Robin's favorite parts of the brain, this disruption to the sort of sense of ego and connecting to each other. But the question, I suppose, is, yes, how long-lasting are they? And I'm guessing, Ros, in psychedelics, does the connection go down? Have you studied long-term?
We haven't used the measure for a long time yet. It's been used at during psychedelic trials, but it hasn't been used in follow-up yet. So just anecdotally, yes, it goes down. But, I mean, I'm talking about people who come to psychedelics having had depression for a long time and then having this opening, and in the opening it's just a general opening, so they become more connected to themselves, to other people and nature. It's this kind of, if you think of it as like a kind of circle, like imagine a kind of circle around your head that's a kind of like, you know, prison of just being stuck in your head, and then that lens just gets wider and wider and wider until it encompasses everything. But then it starts to contract again. And so after about 3 months or so, people tend to be back in their heads again. But I think when we look at study, there's a qualitative analysis of people who have had experiences with psychedelics and nature who have not suffered from depression. And we see there that these pinnacle experiences, peak experiences that people can have, a mystical experience of oneness with nature and awe, where they see themselves as part of that thrumming, vibrating web of life, that can change a life. You know, and sometimes people with depression can have the same experience, but I think it's harder to get through those defenses. But yeah, one experience can have a lifetime impact for some people.
Yeah. And I think it's that sort of, you know, the cognitive flexibility is one thing that's noted, isn't it? You have this, it gives you this cognitive flexibility. It's known as one of my other favourite words, transdiagnostic factor. It connects to many things. And now one thing I should point out is that clinical studies, although they're done in wonderful conditions, are done on your own and in a clinical room. Judy, do you think, like, how... Is it important for us to be in nature with other people? How can we create this nature connection that persists?
I think that the West has to find its own way. It mustn't just copy, you know. And I think that one of the things that we always complain about is that science can be bleak, it can be so analytical, it's cold and all that. We must get away from that and recognise that science can be red hot.
Yes.
It can connect to emotions. It can use the qualities of science to define and to track the nuances of how we work. This is the important contribution of the West. You know, not to just replicate the very basic emotional and cultural wrappings, but to also use science to bring that other dimension of detail of how does it work. And therefore offer also distilled experiences, especially in the urban environment, that can awaken and sustain and feed these feelings of aliveness and oneness with nature.
I think, thank you. And I think that is exactly this sort of, how do we do it in urban community as well? And Ros and I were talking about this thing called communitas, which again is another scale. It's how connected we are to our community. And Judy, this is, you know, this is part of you know, participatory, multicultural sort of environmental interaction is, you know, what you pioneered. Because, of course, connecting to nature helps us connect to others as well. And how have you been facilitating it, encouraging it? You know, how do we work as a group to become part of nature?
This whole intercultural thing is really complex. For example, a lot of people who are connected with people from ethnic minorities, it's done on what I call a tolerance model. We're together now, we're happy together, so that's very nice, full stop. Yeah, we accept each other. But it is actually quite intimidating to cross the boundary because it is really different. And a lot of minority peoples, especially those that grow up in this country and therefore are at least bicultural, people have been educated here. We know the British culture back to front, but we also have inroads into our own culture. But often it is easier and more convenient to be among the mainstream acting like British people, although we are from our minorities, because some of the things that we are afraid that if we talk about them, it will be labelled primitive, ignorant, superstitious, and so on. When actually, at this moment, many of those things are labelled more politely mystical, yeah, are actually very important and real. And when you recognise that reality and are interested in that, to find the right words for it. Because really, we don't have enough words to describe it. And that is part of why we label it wrongly, because there are no words. And when we use certain words, it instigates that feeling of superstition and primitivism and so on, when it is actually real and valid. For example, when I talk to people from the Amazon, and they say to us that everything has a spirit. And they say, oh my God, you know, here we go, you know. But actually, when you begin to feel the intensity of nature, like you did, Catherine, in your experience and so on, one of the words you would use, first of all, is the forest has spirit. How else would you describe it? So those words are in a way still not satisfactory and we need to find new words. But when we recognize the reality of these experiences, that's when we begin to reap the range of human experience and allow ourselves to extend our experience. When I talk about multiculturalism, let's be very scientific. Science now tells us we all come out of Africa. And that we are one single, the whole of humanity, one single blood-related family. For many people, that is really shocking. Especially when I tell them, hey, your ultimate heritage is Africa. Yeah? It is a lot for people to take in. But when I say this, one of the most important things for me is when we recognize this, when we see that the separation through the history of humanity, where we started from Africa, we started to move, we settle here, we settle there, we settle and then we forget and we believe we are unique in that location. But archaeologists will tell you, so simply, you dig under any city, all the layers, that we are all multicultural. And we carry what we had from where we came from, and then as human beings, we create more. And when we create more, we have what we call unique cultures, that are unique combinations of different cultures. But the thing about that is that all cultures, when you abandon yourself to its exposure, if you have a friend from a different culture and really deepen your relationship, abandon yourself to it, there's always a gift of that range of personality that has remained dormant within you in your culture, that's awakened because it was discovered by another culture, but actually has always been your potential and yours, so that we can extend our humanity through different cultures.
See, to me, that's incredibly important, that idea of bringing, you know, those different perspectives together. That's what we do here. We bring science and art together in order to try and create a new way forward. And I think earlier we talked about this is a shift in the ways of seeing right now. There's this sort of different cultures coming together for the first time ever. So with that in mind and understanding this sort of imbalance in accessibility to nature, how do we foster sort of nature connection? How can we start to build infrastructures? What are the tools we have to use in order to help to amplify nature connection? Now, I know obviously, Roz, you can speak to psychedelics, but, you know, beyond that, how would you, you know, like to see this become a toolkit for people?
I think so. I don't really work in psychedelics anymore. So
I know that is also true.
So kind of psychedelics was my kind of like gateway drug to nature. And now through working with people that had these psychedelic experiences and then had this opening and then it kind of closed again and realizing that they needed some access to community and to nature connectedness that was not related to any consuming any substances. That was beyond that for their own, you know, after their own doors opened, like where do they go afterwards? So I don't work in clinical trials anymore. I now work with a community of people. It's an online community, which is itself is kind of paradoxical, really, because we spend a lot of time looking at our laptops. But it's a community for connecting with nature and each other. So it's all about enhancing that connectedness. And we use no psychedelics. But we just use guided imagery visualizations. So every month we have, so the year is divided into 12 months. Each month is symbolized by a different tree. It was inspired by the Celtic tree calendar, rather than trying to borrow nature connectedness practices from other cultures, trying to look back at the culture that I am from. And yeah, discovering that Druidry and, you know, there's a very rich tradition in these isles of deep mystical nature connection. And so, yeah, every month we do the kind of stuff online with breath work and sharing circles and these guided imagery journeys where we merge with a different tree. And the most important part of it is the music, because I think we haven't really talked about that. But for me, connecting with nature and connecting with music, they're kind of interlinked somehow, that sensory experience of deep immersion. So yeah, we have these specific kind of music compositions for each tree, composed by somebody who goes and spends some time with the tree, and then the music comes and then we all listen to this kind of journey. And I do think that for people that don't have a forest on their doorstep, that guided imagery and meditation can be a first step towards opening up the body to receive.
And I think I love that. And we both spoke about meditation. I'm a terrible meditator, by the way. I'm really
Me too.
Bad. But I can do breath work and music. And I know there's people in the audience here who can speak to that as well. And someone in particular, Tom, I am going to get to you to explain what geophony and biophony is in a second. But this idea, and I like that idea of, you know, I don't want us to be naive and go, we'll just take Indigenous wisdom and that will be great and then we'll somehow know how to do it. I think, you know, it's about finding our own way. And Judy, you do, I know you've been campaigning very successfully for London to become a national park and create a future by everybody. Can you tell us a bit about how you're doing that and how you're making it this inclusive campaign?
You know, concepts and contexts are all important in providing frameworks within which we can work to transform how we see and think and feel. So London National Park City, not National Park, but National Park City, strives to try to preserve the most outstanding nature in London. But the most exciting part of it is its aim to discover the potential for wild nature in the built environment. So this requires everyone's imagination and practice to be part of it. We do not dominate with any kind of idea. We actually say, 9 million citizens, 9 million visions. This is the way to go forward, where everyone's recognized, mutually inspire each other and go. And of course, there's lots of people from different cultures. And I think that it's really interesting to tap into what I call the cultural visions of nature, different ways of seeing, alternate ways of aligning our contact in nature. And there are many things that can be revived, for example. For example, we can actually revive the meaning of sacred spaces in the UK. We have lots of sacred spaces. How do we perceive and interact with them? For example, I've just come back from Mexico and I was swimming in what they call the cenotes, the sinkholes in the landscape with beautiful water in the shade, and you get this huge hole and open to the sky. And the idea of being connected to the sky and then deeply through the water into Mother Earth. Ways of connections, but stories too about how people within their own lives configure experience in order to deepen and make alive the connection in nature. I'll tell you one really inspiring story told to me by a Brazilian musician. He said that once upon a time, this is being lost even in Brazil. Of course, all over Europe was the same. If you were to be a musician, you needed to be born into a musical family. You know, you have families of musicians. You don't go to school or anything. Yeah, it was a life purpose that you were born into. And when a child was born, the placenta of the child is planted under a specially selected tree that the parents had gone in the forest to find a very good young tree. And as the child grows, it is taught and supported to nurture this tree. And when finally he becomes a musician, the tree is made into a marimba. And he's playing music on wood, an instrument that is part of himself. Can you imagine that connection that amplifies who you are and amplifies how you contribute creatively through a sound that is physical to yourself? Now, when you listen to that story, I asked you to think about your own lives and the lives of your own children. Are there things that you can construct in ways of thinking, feeling, and doing that feeds that deep connection? You know, these are the challenges that we can find from stories of what people have done to express and amplify those connections. And we can do it. And we can do it only by being absolutely devoted to the idea that we are part of nature. But it is also about science. I keep coming back to this because these two things are really important. Deep connections, physicality, sensuality, all those things, emotions, imagination, but also the power of science so that we do not deny things can be potentially very cold. We call technology cold, we call internet cold and so on. But these are all ways of communication. And what can we give technologically that actually can in those situations, those powerful situations where you can communicate with millions by pressing a button? Exercises and experiences that deepen and sustain that connection.
Thank you. And I think that's why I felt so privileged to have both of you here today, because both of you are bringing science and art together. You know, Judy, your lifetime's work in activism, you know, I remember one interview you said, you know, just doing art wasn't enough, and you went out into the world and you have campaigned for, you know, 50 odd years, incredibly. So thank you. But always in this understanding that there's a part for science and technology as well. And Roz, in, you know, steeped in science and technology, realized there was no connectedness scale in clinical psychology and created one and had one validated to bring the heart into science, to understand that it is that connection between the heart and the head, between ourselves and nature and each other, that is so vital to the way we move forward. But it must, as you've both acknowledged, you know, be a future created. Like you said, you know, in London alone, 9 million imaginations have to be incorporated into this vision. So thank you very much, and thank you both. Thank you so much to our guests, Dr. Rosalind Watts and Dame Judy Ling Wong, for showing us the vital importance and healing power of nature connection. And thank you to 180 House for hosting this session.
And thank you for joining us for this episode of Kinda Conversations. You can find out more about the work of our studio and sign up to our newsletter at kindastudios.com.
If you've enjoyed this, please share. And of course, please subscribe so you know when more episodes are released. We also like ratings and comments too.
See you next time.